This is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple. We're sitting in the Icon Gallery where we make these shows.
And nice and you cool, have, dimly lit.
Yeah. Surrounded by art. So go ahead. You had, this also was from your exploration of the Joseph Campbell material.
Yes, that's right. This is a book that I mentioned a couple of shows ago that I'm reading in the mythology series. It was actually from the beginning. I think this part here is from the first chapter of the primitive mythology book. And he quoted A.E. Housman. This doesn't have anything to do with primitive mythology. It was just leading into a thought that, you know, area of exploration he was going into. So he quoted A.E. Housman, the poet, as saying, "Poetry is not the thing said, but a way of saying it." And then he also said, "The intellect is not the fount of poetry, and it may actually hinder its production and cannot even be trusted to recognize poetry when it is produced." And then, so that was the Housman quote, and then Joseph Campbell went on to say that art, whether poetry, music, dance, architecture, painting, sculpture, whatever, is not, like science, a logic of references, but a release from references and renditions of immediate experience. He said, "Art is a presentation of forms, images, or ideas in such a way that they will communicate not primarily a thought or even a feeling, but an impact." And the reason that he quoted that and made that point was he then led into talking about archetypal symbols that are common to all cultures and how when you see one of these symbols, it has an impact on you whether you know what it's supposed to mean or not. It has nothing, it's not on the level of meaning. So anyway, I think that would be an interesting direction to explore.
Well, the thing of it, the artwork not referring to but getting away from reference, I think we've touched on this many times, that it's like a crack in the reality structure so that life itself comes through. Yeah. So more the name of it happens with art rather than, and we were discussing, I think, in that other show you just referred to, the parts beginning to take on a life of their own, and so the whole is lost, and so things get serious, and that there's a sense of loss, because if any of those parts disappear, then there's this horrible loss. I think art objects, great art, relieves us of that, of those constrictions and that boundedness, and we're opened up to a glimpse of the name of the real thing. And so yeah, it has that impact that you
It has,
about.
Right. And you can't, that's why, just, you know, going back to the Housman quote about how the intellect is not even reliable to discern whether something is poetry, the same thing is true of art, because, and I've done this myself, I've looked at a Paul Klee painting or a Kandinsky painting or something like that and tried to figure out what he was doing and why he made the choice to put this curved line here and why he did this. And you do that, and because my intellect has a lot of tricks up its sleeve, it can convince itself that it really is figuring it out. And, oh, he did this. Oh, he was trying to do that and make this look, you know. And then I will sit down and try to do that in a painting, and nothing happens. It's not, because it isn't on that level.
Right.
It's not, can't even be analyzed on that level. It's something that is, and all of it, which is why when you watch films about artists talking about their work, it's often very hard for them to find words to describe what they're doing, even after the fact.
And this is especially hard as a teacher, because to teach that is the most elusive thing and the most and the only really important thing. Because the students will want you to teach them the formula, and they'll look at paintings and they'll try to start to analyze a formula or something, And there is harmonics and geometry and all sorts of stuff in there that you can see, but it's not a simple formula at all, because the magic, the element where the wholeness is released is mysterious and can't be known except for by the person who is in a holistic state doing it. And then it gets into the work, and then what we, the thing that, the impact is when that overtakes us. But when the intellect gets involved to try to figure out why, that's what students want me to tell them. You know, is it, you know, why is this why it's working? Is this the thing to do? And then they try to do it, and you get something that is very simplistic. When you start applying a formula, it's very simplistic and it's completely lacking of wholeness
and lacking in vitality.
Well, it just is just that's how you make a work of art that isn't a work of art, but is just decorative.
There's a wonderful Billy Collins. Billy Collins is one of my favorite poets, and there's a wonderful Billy Collins poem about how his poetry student, he teaches in a college, and how his poetry students relate to a poem. And I can't remember all of the examples that he gives. They're wonderful examples about how what he wants them to do, and you know, similar to things like brush against it lightly with the back of their hand, you know, watch it flutter on a breeze, or whatever images that he uses. And then he ends the poem by saying, but all they want to do is put it under a microscope and dissect it to find its meaning. and it's true. It's hard to resist that temptation with art, music.
Well students want to learn how to do it. They want to know how to do it.
And they want to know how to understand what somebody else did.
Right.
Too, even if they don't want to do it. You know, with poetry, I think that's I remember studying poetry in school and not really getting what poetry was all about and being really frustrated because the meaning was not obvious. You know, it was just like, well, what? This is weird. And I think a lot of people, when they approach poetry, have the same reaction. Billy Collins actually was asked when he was poet laureate to produce. I think every poet laureate has to do some project that's going to kind of make a difference in the world of poetry. And what he chose to do is this brilliant thing. He put together a book, I think he called it Poetry 108, because there were like 108 days in the school year or something like that. And he made a book, an anthology of poems that he selected, most of them contemporary, but some were older, that he felt were really accessible to high school age people because they would like hit them in the gut, you know, and yet they were perfectly within the dimension of the best poetry. And the editing of this book, his choices were just miraculous. You pick up this book and no matter what your attitude is towards poetry, the poems impact, you know, they have that impact on you. And so he gets through to people. And his instruction when he put together this book and sent it around to high schools was no commentary from the teacher. You know, the assignment is just read the poem to the students. That's it. It's just about, you know, the relationship purely to the poetry. And they loved it. It was a marvelously successful project that he did.
Of course, it would depend a lot on the teacher who reads the poem.
Mm-hmm. And possibly, maybe the students had a copy of it that they could read as well, because you're right.
I mean, I remember my seventh grade homeroom teacher, Humphrey L.G. Fry, was a very dignified British gentleman who, to teach writing, simply read to us. And he would pick these pieces of exquisite prose, and then he would read them exquisitely.
Mm.
And you'd get so much from what he was reading that you'd think, my God, how do you do that? You know, what on earth is the technique? And of course, there isn't a technique. It's a good writer. It's a great writer in most cases. you know, writing something in a style that he loves, and you know, it's like some great work that's stood the test of time for generations. And but it would focus your attention on what makes great writing. Mm. And if he hadn't been a good reader, we'd have sat there, you know, just falling asleep, because it would have been horrible. And there, you know, there, some people can't read out loud to save their lives. And they're perfectly intelligent, capable people. It's just they've never practiced that skill enough or something.
So after he read you the passages, then did you all write?
Then we discussed how the author had done it. The mm-hmm. focus of the course was style. Mm-hmm. We had two textbooks. One was Drunk and White, Elements of Style, and the other one was Fowler's Modern English Usage. And so we, you know, he would guide the conversation a little bit, but he would pretty much let it go wherever it needed to go, and people would pick sections that they thought had been particularly effective. And sometimes it was an adventure story or something, and other times it was a mystery, and other times it was, you know, an essay on some, you know, abstract subject. But there were always sections that grabbed you somewhere. And of course, he had selected particularly wonderful examples. I'd love to see the curriculum now. I don't remember exactly what we did. I remember we did the 39 Steps was one of the books, but. So that we would explore in a sort of open conversation, you know, how the writer had done what he did, how he'd accomplished what he had accomplished. And so someone would say, well, I really thought it was great the way he just mentioned these things, you know, one after another, and each one was more dangerous than the one before. And the teacher would point out that, you know, that's a great way of escalating the reader's attention. And he's not saying next time you want to get the reader really focused on something, start with something that's mildly, you know, energizing, and then make a list of things that are more and more energizing, because that's not going to work. But you got a feel for it, mm-hmm. and the feeling for it really came through the fact that the reader totally understood what was being done. And that's part of, I guess, part of my inspiration to try to do the same kind of thing on a larger scale and teach writing style on the basis of the writer learning how to read out loud.
Yeah, yeah, this is great. That's a really wonderful point, because there are a lot of great writers who will say that the way to, you know, somebody will say, well, what do I have to do to become a writer? And most of them will say, read, 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 read. You know, that it's, and the same thing with art. One of the things that I've learned in teaching art classes out of my home, I have a vast collection of art books, and I'm always like, when in making some point, instead of explaining it to them, pulling a book down and say, look at this painting by Matisse, or look at this painting by Rousseau, or whatever, you know, that brings out that and illustrates it, and then I hardly have to say anything because they'll see it.
Yeah.
In the work, and something does, and it goes back to what we were talking about a couple of shows ago about, or no, it was this show, wasn't it? About the impact, yeah.
Yeah.
Seems like a long time ago. Ages ago.
About that when you hear something like that, the great literature, that when somebody reads a piece of great literature, or when you look at a great painting, the impact is there. And even though you don't know how he did it, like how Cézanne got those luminous colors and all of that, it makes you want to paint. Mm-hmm. It sparks something in you that makes you want to relate to fruit that way and make a work of art. And the same thing happens with writing, because when I'm reading a good book, I can be in a total non-writing phase of my life, but if I read something that's incredibly amazing use of words, it will make me want to sit down and play with words.
Yeah, yeah. I guess if someone asked me how to become a great writer, I would say read, 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 and as much as possible read out loud. Hmm. And probably also to someone if they're if you can find someone who will tolerate that.
So tell me what the difference is, because I think I know, because I do the same thing, but tell the listening audience what the difference is between reading it out loud and reading it
to yourself. Well, there are several differences, and some of them are rather profound. When you read to yourself, if you read a sentence that you don't completely understand, you just say, well, I kind of know what that meant, and you go right on reading. When you read out loud, you hear what you're saying, and if you don't understand it, it comes out false, and you can hear that you didn't get it, and you feel kind of stupid saying something that you don't understand, and so you're forced to, you know, read with greater insight. But there are other effects too, one of which, and this applies more to why it helps you to become a better writer, is that the process of reading out loud causes you or requires you to kind of scan ahead with your eyes while you're speaking the part you just read. And your eyes pick up the content and the brain processes it and you take it inside, and then you have to comprehend it in order to know how to speak it. Because if you want to put the right expression on the words and pause in the right places, you have to know what it is that he's trying to say. So you're taking the writer's writing and you're turning it into your own thinking, and then you're speaking the thinking that you're doing, and you end up speaking the writer's words, but you're speaking it after you have understood it. So there's a couple of levels of comprehension going on, and it's the language, the printed word is getting digested and becoming the spoken word, which you then hear. Yeah. And evaluate. Mm-hmm. You know whether you said it well, you know whether you delivered that last sentence clearly, or if there was some weird ambiguity in it that you didn't notice until it started coming out of your mouth. And then ideally you just have to apologize and go back and, you know, try and read it more intelligibly. But if you read with the intention of informing what it is that you're reading with your own intelligence, then you begin to learn to think the way the writer was thinking when he wrote that stuff. And that's how he did great writing. He didn't do it by studying his own writing. He did it by being himself and being engaged in the subject matter in that way. And now you're getting a taste of being engaged in the subject matter in the same way. And you're becoming, in a sense, an extension of the writer. I think it's very, very profound. I know that anything that I write, it doesn't finish its development until I've read it out loud several times. And I can hear it bouncing off of my imaginary, you know, listener, or bouncing better off of real listeners, because when I read it to someone who is a skeptical person, I hear my own voice with a little skepticism. And when I read it to someone who is a humorous person, I hear my own words through the ears of a person who is looking for what's funny about it. And that all changes the way I process the experience, and it gives me new insight into the way I worded it. And I'll see that something is misleading because I've tried to be too explicit, and I've ended up making it complicated, or something is not working because these two words together can mean two different things, and I hadn't thought of that when I first wrote them down, and I need to pick a different word or separate them or something. So I think reading out loud is a tremendously powerful tool if you do it deliberately. Yeah. and if you have this intention of reading expressively and helping the language.
Well, what's fascinating about that, I mean, this is, I've never heard it described so well, you know, of what's actually happening, but as you were talking, I realized that for me has been my way of understanding something that I didn't really relate to very well, I'm reading a math textbook or something like that, and right. If I do that and read it out loud, I'm engaging more of my brain.
Yes.
And when I would be helping the kids with their homework when they were little, Adrian, because she's a very auditory person, couldn't really learn things by just reading them in the book silently. She didn't have visual memory like I did in school, if I could, I could sort of picture it on the page. She couldn't do that. She had to hear it out loud. So to help her with her homework, I would have to read it out loud to mm-hmm. her. And in the process of doing that, I found myself getting completely enthralled by subjects that I didn't think I was interested in.
Yeah.
And wouldn't have probably if I had just picked up the book and read it silently.
Yeah.
It just would have not engaged me. So that's very fascinating, but I love the description that you just gave.
Well, I think one can read stuff without being involved in it at all. I mean, you can even read it out loud. I mean, it's like driving a car. You suddenly realize, wow, I just drove a half a mile and I don't remember any of it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because you blacked out. It's because it just didn't leave an impression. And the same thing can happen when you're reading something that's not engaging you. You keep looking at the words and you get a few paragraphs and you think, I'm not sure what was in those last couple of paragraphs, but it doesn't really matter. And you go sort of rolling on. And to some extent, you can do that reading out loud. You can, you know, just keep reading and you sort of drone on and you don't really think about what you're saying and the words are going in your eyes and coming out your mouth. But if you read in an engaged manner with this commitment to do justice to the words and you know,
like you're giving a performance almost.
Yeah, sort of like that. I mean, you're trying to speak the words with the proper emphasis and, you know, pause in the right places. Speak them as if you understand what you're saying and it's your thought. When you do that, I think it engages your whole mind. And so you're having a holistic experience of this sequence of thoughts that the writer has encoded on paper instead of just getting the words out. And you know the difference. You know, you listen to someone who is reading a book, that the book that they are reading has many sentences in it and they are interesting. I mean, that's what it sounds like when people are just reading. Mm-hmm. But when they're delivering the content, you know, by reading, then it's a whole different kettle of fish and it gets very interesting.
Well, and what came to mind when you were talking too is that's probably why it's so interesting for people to be actors.
Yeah.
Because they are essentially saying out loud the script that some writer wrote and they're making, you know, so that it isn't just, the purpose isn't just to create a good entertainment for the audience, but something, it's a way for them to explore different vantage points on reality.
It's true, and I'm glad you brought that up because there's a tremendous distinction between reading and reciting. The actor has memorized the words now, and they've gone down into a different level of the actor's, you know, consciousness. And the actor's responsibility now is to make those his own words and to know why he's speaking them and stuff. In the case of reading, you still have this written word cycle, this loop, where you have only a few seconds to glance at the words you're about to speak. And there's this sort of urgency that they get processed right now using the alert mind so that you can speak them intelligently. But while you're speaking them intelligently, you're reading the next line, the next sentence, and processing that the same way and making sure that the continuity is what it's supposed to be. And that puts a different demand on your awareness and it puts a different focus on things. And I think that's how, really, I think that's a better way of learning to be a better writer through reading aloud. Mm-hmm. Whereas, or I should say through reading aloud, whereas memorizing, your attention is on, can I remember the next line? Mm. What is the next line supposed to be? Now, if you memorize it to the point where it is truly second nature, and better yet, if you're performing it in a play over and over again till you have the character down pat and the lines are absolutely natural and they might as well be spontaneous, then, of course, you get a particular depth of understanding. I mean, I did Waiting for Godot that way many years ago, and we rehearsed it for almost 3 months So we knew the play cold. There
Who
was never
play?
Pazzo. Oh. I am Pazzo. And David Mamet played Estragon, which was
David
exciting.
Really?
Yeah,
oh, wow.
Yeah, he was a classmate. But doing this is a rare thing. I mean, very few people get to be in a play and do a major role and get to do it often enough and well enough and deeply enough with good enough directing and so on to really own that character. Although the value from that is spectacular, and Beckett is a permanent part of my life as a result of that, and Shakespeare too, in other contexts, reading aloud gives you an opportunity to gain something very special that I don't think there's another you know avenue to obtaining it. It's just this kind of urgent thing of grasping what the author is saying and getting it out in an intelligent way while you're grasping the next thing that he's saying and getting that out. And that loop keeps going and puts a demand on your alertness that nothing else quite does. Even if the audience is just a friend or even no one, just mm-hmm. yourself hearing the sound of your own voice.
Yeah, I do that a lot of times in my home, just read something out loud.
Yeah.
Rather than silently, because it is a richer.
It's a lot more interesting
experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if you're not using it, as you were saying, to help you be a better writer.
Yeah.
Just to embrace the information or whatever, the content and the other thing about reading out loud too is then you're able to really appreciate the, if it's a good writer, like a really good fiction writer or something like that. There's often a great consciousness for the sound of the words and the rhythm of the sentences and all of that. And when you read out loud, you gain an insight into that aspect of the author's work. Is
right.
Like, oh, that sentence is very staccato, and that sentence really flows in a liquid way, and so forth.
Yeah. And of course, many people believe that poetry should only be read out loud.
Right, I've
heard
that.
It should not be read silently to yourself, and I'm inclined to subscribe to that, although I tend to read poetry silently to myself, but I don't tend to enjoy it very much unless I actually read it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.